Constitutional scholar Jeffrey Rosen on presidential powers and upcoming Supreme Court cases of note. So far, the Trump administration has kept constitutional lawyers and scholars quite busy. There's the travel ban, questions about the power to pardon, and potential retirements from the court. Today, I'm fortunate to have one of the country's leading constitutional scholars as a guest. Jeffrey Rosen is president and chief executive officer of the National Constitution Center. It is the only institution in America chartered by Congress to disseminate information about the United States Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. He's with me here at the College of the Atlantic as part of their new Champlain Institute, which brings leaders from around the country and the world to share their expertise on pressing issues of our time. Jeffrey Rosen and constitutional issues in the news, next on Maine Calling. But first, this news. Live from the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The current presidential administration has given constitutional scholars, as well as others, a lot to ponder and talk about recently. There is the travel ban, presidential pardon powers, and the role of the executive orders, among other issues in the news today. I'm fortunate to have as my guest today a leading constitutional scholar. Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. He is also a professor, a fellow at a major think tank, and an author of books and articles. We are here in this beautiful setting at the College of the Atlantic as part of the college's new Champlain Institute. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks for joining us here on Maine Calling.
It is wonderful to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. What do you in the audience here and the audience that's listening on your radio, what do you want to know? What constitutional issues matter most to you? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. First off, Jeffrey, tell us about the National Constitution Center. How did it come about and what's its purpose?
The National Constitution Center has a very inspiring purpose that comes from the U.S. Congress. It was founded during the bicentennial of the Constitution to disseminate information about the U.S. Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. Imagine that inspiring mission. And we fulfill it as a museum of we the people. It's this spectacular temple to the Constitution on Independence Mall, right across from Independence Hall in Philadelphia, with the rarest original drafts of the Constitution, one of the 12 original copies of the Bill of Rights, this beautiful Hall of the Signers, where you can see life-size statues of the framers and commune with the Constitution. But it's also a national center for education and debate about the Constitution, and that's why I'm so excited to be out here in my favorite place in the world. I know it's dangerous to say this on NPR, but Bar Harbor, Maine, and Mount Desert Island is the most glorious place in America, and we're here at the Champlain Institute at the College of the Atlantic, fulfilling the National Constitution Center's mission to educate people on every media platform. So I want Maine Calling listeners to educate themselves as we're talking now. And I want you to start by downloading the crown jewel of our educational materials, which is the Interactive Constitution. And people can find it in the App Store at Interactive Constitution or on the web at constitutioncenter.org with the co-sponsorship of the leading liberal and conservative lawyers organizations in America. We have nominated the top liberal and conservative scholars to write about every clause of the Constitution, describing what they agree about and what they disagree about. Kenji Ishina is here in the audience. He's going to be talking later this week. He was a contributor to a clause of the Interactive Constitution with a counterpart nominated by the Conservative Federalist Society. And it's so inspiring to be able to click on any of the 80 clauses of the Constitution and see 1,000 words that both sides agree to. It's like a unanimous Supreme Court opinion. It's an inspiring civic and educational exercise. But that's not all. I'm like a constitutional
kinsman. And here, Jeffrey, I had made a note to ask you about the app. I don't think I need to do that.
No, you don't.
But tell me again what it's under in the App Store.
Well, thank you again for asking the name. It's called the Interactive Constitution, and it's completely free, and it's gotten 10 million hits since it launched a year ago. Khan Academy is doing videos around it. The College Board has made it the center of the new AP exams. I really want every American from 8 to 80 to download and learn from this incredible resource, which everyone from law law professors and Supreme Court justices to citizens from 6 to 60 and 8 to 80 are learning from. But this inspiring model of bringing together liberals and conservatives is one that we're taking around the country. We have an amazing series of traveling town hall debates that are going to cities from San Francisco to Chicago to Grand Rapids, Michigan, which bring together scholars of different perspectives to debate current constitutional issues. We have this wonderful podcast, which I want people to listen to, and I'd love Maine Public Radio to think about running. It's called We the People. And every week, I call up the leading liberal and conservative scholar in the country to debate the constitutional issue of the week. Is the travel ban unconstitutional? Was the firing of James Comey a constitutional crisis? What is the future of political gerrymandering at the Supreme Court? What's so exciting about these podcasts is they're on constitutional, not political topics. We don't ask, is the travel ban a good or bad idea? We ask, does it violate the First Amendment's prohibition on establishments of religion, or does it violate federal statutes? And by bringing together liberals and conservatives for constitutional rather than political debates, the debates are always civil. There's sometimes unexpected agreement and disagreement, and it just elevates things in ways that educates everyone. So that's what we're doing. You can tell I'm very enthusiastic about this job.
Well, it's interesting because you just posed some of the questions I was planning to ask you, Jeffrey. Yeah. So perhaps you might want to ask the question and answer it. No, I'm kidding. No, I'll do that to you.
I can describe the arguments on both sides in a nonpartisan spirit.
But well, is it difficult these days to be nonpartisan?
Well, it's always difficult to be nonpartisan, but it's all the more meaningful than ever because this is a very polarized time and people disagree very strongly about politics. And we are not going to persuade ourselves about the right political answer. People are dug into red and blue America and into their filter bubbles and echo chambers. And unfortunately, the possibility of deliberation and collaboration is elusive. But people can realize the importance of rising above their politics and educating themselves about something that unites us. The U.S. Constitution is the one document that unites us. We may disagree about what it means, but we often can learn about its text and history, about what the Supreme Court has said. And what's so exciting about these discussions is we often vote before and after, and people sometimes change their minds. At the end of the debate, we ask whose mind has been changed by the debate, and often, or at least sometimes, people will reach a constitutional conclusion that diverges from their political conclusion. So, for example, they might think that the travel ban is a good idea, but the Constitution forbids it, or they might think the travel ban is a bad idea, but the Constitution allows it. And just that exercise, which law students are trained to engage in all the time, is something the National Constitution Center is trying to bring to all Americans of all ages, and it's a really meaningful and exciting civic enterprise.
Jeffrey Rosen, I'm going to ask you some of those questions. President Trump has suggested via tweet a broad pardon policy. Can the president pardon himself?
We have not yet hosted a podcast on that, although we will, so I'll be better informed to describe the arguments on both sides soon. But from what I've learned so far from our phenomenal Constitution Center prep team, I'm not going to take the time to click on the pardon clause of the interactive Constitution, which would tell us more. The authorities are split on this question. Some argue that the president cannot pardon himself on the grounds that no person should be judged in his own case, and neither the King of England nor any U.S. president has issued a self-pardon before. The argument on the other side is that the pardon power is limited in only one way in the Constitution. It extends to all cases except for impeachment. So the president can't pardon himself in a way that would make him immune from impeachment. In fact, some might view a self-pardon itself as grounds for impeachment. Impeachment is whatever Congress says it is, as Gerald Ford memorably replied, so we haven't tested that yet. But all this is to say that imagine, hypothetically, that the president were prospectively to pardon himself from criminal prosecution after he leaves office. After he leaves office, a prosecutor might bring a case anyway, saying a self-pardon is impermissible, and that would go up to the Supreme Court. And for the first time in history, the court would resolve the issue. Like so many constitutional issues, the question is unresolved. There's not clear text, history, or precedent, so the court could go either way. But I've very quickly described the arguments on both sides, and I'm looking forward to learning more.
The concept of a pre-pardon has come up for members of his staff. Is that also an unresolved issue?
No, pre-pardons are well established. The president can pardon anyone for any crimes they have committed or may have committed. We have localized examples of that where President Gerald Ford pardon Richard Nixon for past and future crimes. And then we have broader pardons, like Jimmy Carter's famous pardon of Vietnam draft dodgers against prosecution. So the president could pardon Jared Kushner or his son, Donald J. Trump Jr., for crimes they have committed or may commit in the future. And that would raise the question of, can a pardon of someone else be illegal? During the Clinton years, the Justice Department and the special prosecutor were looking into the possibility that President Clinton's pardon of Mark Rich might have been issued in exchange for bribes. And the thought was, if a pardon is issued for corrupt purposes, that itself might lead to a prosecution for corruption. In the end, that prosecution was not brought, so the question wasn't tested. But it's theoretically possible that if the president pre-pardoned or prospectively pardoned any of his family members or aides, that pardon itself could be tested in court. Still, a pardon of Jared Kushner wouldn't shut down the whole Russia investigation. Other people could continue to be investigated. The question of whether you could have a blanket pre-pardon for anyone connected with the Trump campaign who has been or might have been involved with any wrongdoing involving Russia hasn't been tested, but that would be an interesting podcast for the future.
Speaking of interesting podcasts, I think you mentioned that you did one on gerrymandering. Many people have suggested that the hyper-partisan politics right now are because of gerrymandering, that districts, congressional districts, are either so heavily Republican or so heavily Democratic that instead of having people in the center and having the general election be the contested election, the primary is actually the contested election. Do you agree that gerrymandering is a problem? And is there a constitutional solution for it?
So I had thought before we hosted this great debate that the argument you just described was convincing, that because the whole election is about the primary and people no longer have to go to the center in the general, that's responsible for polarization. I changed my mind after hearing President McCarty of Princeton explain that the reason we have polarization in America is not because of gerrymandering, but because of the Big Sort. It's because red and blue people live in geographically separate areas. So however you draw the voting district in a hard red or hard blue area, you're going to get extremely partisan districts with very few swing voters. If we have a polarization problem in America, in other words, it's the result of geographic and virtual self-sorting, not partisan gerrymandering. That doesn't mean that partisan gerrymandering is not a problem. The Supreme Court next term will hear an extremely important case, perhaps the most important on partisan gerrymandering in a generation. And the claim in that case is that districts in some places have been so gerrymandered that a party can win a minority of the votes and still get a majority of the seats. So in that case, the Republican Party got something like 46% of the votes, but 60% of the seats. And the claim here is that if the imbalance between the proportion of votes and seats you get is above a certain percentage, that is an unconstitutional gerrymander. The court will decide that next term. Justice Anthony Kennedy, the swing vote in this case, has said, I believe that maybe some gerrymanders are too extreme, but come back and show me a formula that I can use to identify what an extreme gerrymander is. Here, a bunch of professors led by some very able people at Columbia have proposed a formula for when a gerrymander is too extreme. We'll see what Justice Kennedy says and also what our new Justice Neil Gorsuch says about that important question.
We're speaking with constitutional scholar Jeffrey Rosen. You mentioned that that's one of the cases you'll be watching in the upcoming year. What are other important cases that you're going to be watching that the new Supreme Court with Gorsuch will be taking up?
Gosh, if last term was something, all constitutional terms are exciting, but last term was rather mild because the 4-4 court was avoiding hotly contested questions. Next term, as Justice Ginsburg said, will be a constitutional feast. So the first one I'm going to be watching is the cell phone privacy case, U.S. versus Carpenter, which could define the future of digital privacy in America. The question in that case is, can the government subpoena the cell phone records from a suspect in an armed robbery, suspected, ironically, of stealing cell phones, and reconstruct his movements for an entire Actually, it was 5 months, 127 days. This is such an important case because the Supreme Court previously has said that the police can't put a global positioning system device on the bottom of a car and track someone for a month because that can reveal so much information about us. But that case turned, for the majority, on the fact that there was a physical trespass involved. The police had to walk onto the guy's driveway and physically put the device on the bottom of his car. In this case, you can get the cell phone records merely by subpoenaing them from Verizon or Comcast or whatever our cell phone carrier is. And in a series of important cases, the court has held in the past that when I surrender information to a third party like Comcast, I abandon all expectation of privacy in it. That's a case called Smith and Maryland. I was just talking about this case at the Chautauqua Institute last week, and in an amazing moment of synchronicity, sitting in the first row was the lawyer who argued Smith versus Maryland in 1979. And although he won that case, he stood up and said he did not believe it should apply to cell phone surveillance because you can learn so much more about reconstructing someone's movements for a month or 5 months through their cell phone records than you could by the pen registered, which merely captured a few days of phone numbers, which was the privacy invasion in Smith and Maryland. So that's one big one. I can talk about it. There's another really cool
one, too.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can a baker refuse to bake a wedding cake for gay couples because the baker disapproves of marriage equality? It's such a hard case, important case, and raises important questions about compelled speech under the First Amendment. The baker says, I shouldn't be forced to exercise my art in a way that embraces views I don't agree in. I am an Miro of the pastry set, and my cakes are confections of aesthetic expression. And to force me to say I approve of gay marriage violates my rights of artistic expression. The argument on the other side is that a baking store is a place of public accommodations, and ordinarily a store owner is not allowed to refuse to serve gays and lesbians or African Americans or women or anyone else because they disapprove of the people in question, and therefore there should be no exemption from anti-discrimination laws for the First Amendment. The case is much more complicated, and the twists of compelled speech are rather intricate, but it's going to be an amazing case. And the backdrop of this is a series of cases where the court recently has held that a religiously scrupulous corporation doesn't have to give contraception coverage under the Affordable Care Act. So the question of the scope of exemptions for religiously scrupulous business owners from anti-discrimination laws is very much at the forefront of the court, and that's why the case is going to be so incredibly interesting.
So fun to have constitutional scholar Jeffrey Rosen with us here on Maine Calling. We do have to take a very short break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Please stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We are broadcasting today from the beautiful College of the Atlantic campus in Bar Harbor. With me today, Jeffrey Rosen, a constitutional scholar and president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. We're discussing the myriad of constitutional matters in the news these days. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page, and I will add to our everyday list anybody in the audience who has a question for Jeffrey Rosen may ask it as well. We'll start with an email question from Mary in China Village. Jeffrey, do you think the originalist Supreme Court justice's position is valid? Why or why not?
Well, at the nonpartisan National Constitution Center, I need to describe to you the arguments for and against it. So the argument for originalism is based in Federalist 78 by Alexander Hamilton. And Hamilton said that the nature of a written constitution means that it's supreme law. And therefore, when you have a conflict between the supreme law expressing the will of the people, represented by the Constitution, and the will of the people's representatives, their servants, their temporary representatives, you should prefer the will of the master to the servant, the principal to the agent. So the whole theory is that in order to make the Constitution supreme law, you have to look at the will of the people who ratified it, and therefore what's relevant is not the secret views of Madison and Hamilton and the Constitutional Convention, but the views of the original public meaning of the document at the time that it was ratified in 1789 or the Reconstruction Amendments in 1868 and so forth and all the way up through the Bill of Rights. So that's the argument for originalism. There are many arguments against originalism, not least of which is the dead hand of the past. Why should we be ruled today by the wishes of dead white men. Women couldn't vote. African Americans couldn't vote. And does it really make sense to say that the will of the people, the considered supreme will of the people, is better represented by those of 18th century ratifiers than by people in the here and now? That's why there are a lot of other methodologies of constitutional interpretation. And what I want listeners to do is be like good students of the Constitution. Learn about those methodologies. There's not only textualism and originalism, but also an emphasis on precedent. What has the Supreme Court said before? History and tradition. What has American tradition said over the past 100 years? Pragmatism. What's a good, sensible, practical solution to these questions? Natural law. What rights do we have from God or nature and not government, and how should they apply to unforeseen circumstances? Those are just some of the methodologies. You can mix and match them. You could be a pragmatic originalist or a historically minded natural law person, but all I want listeners to do is not pick a methodology because they like the political results. Don't be an originalist just because you think it'll lead to conservative results, because originalism, honestly applied in many cases, should lead to liberal as well as conservative results, as many judges found when they struck down NSA surveillance on the grounds that it was like the general warrants that sparked the American Revolution. So be a good constitutional methodology person and pick the one you like the best.
All right. Well, we're going to try to go to the phones here. I'm going to start with, let's see here, Anthony calling from Waterville. Hi, Anthony. Go ahead. Sure. Clearly trouble there with the phone. So we'll see. Go back to emails for a little while. See if we can figure that out. You've mentioned this one. This is from Steve in an email. A bakery does not wish to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. 53 years ago, the Supreme Court forced the desegregation of Ollie's Barbecue. The foundation of that case was the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. Why is the Commerce Clause not being used in the bakery case?
Great question. A really wonderful constitutional question. There, the question was a federal statute, the Civil Rights Act, which required places of public accommodation to not discriminate. And the question was, what is Congress's authority to pass that law? The natural place to justify that law would have been Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. The 14th Amendment passed 150 years ago that guarantees equal protection of the law and forbids states from denying the privileges or immunities of citizenship to anyone, contains a section, Section 5, that says Congress shall have the power to enforce this by appropriate legislation. And you would think that an anti-discrimination law would be a natural place to justify that. However, the Supreme Court, in some cases in the 19th century, including the civil rights cases from 1875, dramatically restricted the scope of Section 5 of the 14th Amendment in ways that were arguably inconsistent with the broad understanding of its framers, who thought that Congress should have a lot of power to pass anti-discrimination laws. And because of that precedent, the court was forced, with the brilliant lawyership of Burke Marshall, a late Yale law professor who had come up with this theory. He said, well, the 14th Amendment doesn't work anymore. Let's look to Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. And ever since the New Deal, the court interpreted that so broadly that if an action has any effect on interstate commerce, it's generally upheld. So it was just because of that quirk of history that the Commerce Clause rather than the 14th Amendment was used. It would be great for the originalist justices like Justice Clarence Thomas, who cares a lot about Reconstruction history, to resurrect Section 5 of the 14th Amendment and to root Congress's broad power to fight anti-discrimination on that provision. The reason it's not at issue in the baking case is because I believe that it's a state anti-discrimination law that's at stake, not a federal one, and therefore it's not a question of Congress's power to compel anti-discrimination, but the state's power, which is indisputed. The question here is whether the bakers should basically have an exemption from those laws because of their First Amendment rights of artistic expression, which trump state anti-discrimination laws to the contrary, if in fact they clash. And the question here is, do the two rights clash?
All right, we have a question in the audience. Go ahead.
Greetings. My name's Hugh Clark. From last night, conversation you did with Ryan Leeson today, there's so many questions one might want to ask, but I'm going to focus on something you said earlier this afternoon, and this is the power of the president to pre-pardon. If we go back 500 years to the Reformation, one of the big issues in the Reformation was, in fact, the Pope's right to pre-pardon. If Mr. Trump, indeed, or any president, has the right to pre-pardon, could he not command one of his guys to go shoot Hillary Clinton with a pre-pardon, and that would be exempt from any punishment. You know, are there truly no limits, in other words, on the idea of pre-pardon?
That is a wonderful question. And thinking aloud, I guess, you know, we conceived of a case where the pardon power could be exercised corruptly. Clinton could be bribed to give a pardon, and that would violate corruption laws. So if the president's purpose in this case were to commit murder himself, and he deputized his son to commit the murder and pre-pardoned the son, then you could say that he was corruptly using the pardon power to immunize himself from a murder prosecution. Then you reach the really hard question, which is why it's such a great one. Make it simpler. Remember President Trump said during the campaign, I could go shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and my supporters wouldn't care. Let's imagine that the president shot someone on Fifth Avenue and killed them today. This is a hypothetical, I need to stress. Could he be prosecuted for murder now? The weight of authority says no, that you'd have to wait until he was out of office in order to prosecute him for the criminal act. The argument on the other side is what possible justification could there be from immunizing the president from a murder prosecution? The right remedy is impeachment and so forth, but you could debate that. But essentially, I think that everyone agrees that the president could be prosecuted for murder after he leaves office, and therefore if he used the pardon power to basically commit murder by proxy, then a pre-pardon of that person might not stand up and could be challenged on those grounds. Wonderful question.
We have an email question from Alex. Please explain the separation of powers in our federal government versus the separation of powers in the British parliamentary system.
Great question also. In the British Parliament, I learned when I studied it as a kid, is considered an elective dictatorship. The king in Parliament, now represented by the prime minister in Parliament, can basically do anything that she likes, unconstrained by separate branches of government. So Brexit could never happen in America because we don't authorize fundamental constitutional change by referenda. We have to go through lots of hard steps. You have to convince the three branches of government or go through a constitutional amendment. In Britain, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, could just decide that he wanted a fundamental constitutional vote with a one-off decision and authorize the referendum and basically transform the Constitution. The British High Court held that that was wrong and that Parliament had to ratify the decision in order to maintain parliamentary sovereignty, but that reinforced the idea that the Prime Minister, who's the executive, plus Parliament together can basically do whatever they liked. Until recently, Britain had no Supreme Court, and it didn't have a Bill of Rights. Recently, it's created a Supreme Court, and the European Bill of Rights had been enforced after Brexit. That remains questionable. But the U.S. system is completely different. We do not believe that the power of we the people can be exercised in our name by a prime minister acting with our legislatures. We believe that our power is so sovereign that it has to be parceled out to different branches of government, to Congress and the president and the courts, all of whom have to agree in order for a law to go into passage. The president has to propose a bill, Congress has to pass it, and the Supreme Court has to uphold its constitutionality. There was a lot of lamenting of the inefficiency of the American system in the 1970s when people like Lloyd Cutler talked about the iron triangle of interests that paralyzed American government and called for a British-style system. Now, at a time of polarization, suddenly progressives as well as conservatives are rediscovering the virtues of the separation of powers. They like the fact that it's hard for Congress to pass fundamental reforms like health care just off the bat. And the decision of the U.S. to separate and distribute power is looking like a very wise move.
We have another question from the audience.
Hello, my name is Grant Kleiser from New York City. I just have a question somewhat related to the previous question, but this has to do with the Bill of Rights and the British versus American constitutional system. Alexander Hamilton in, I believe, Federalist 84, argued against an expressly written Bill of Rights because he worried that everything not expressly forbidden would be permitted, whereas the British Constitution is unwritten, and so there's nothing, you know, no explicit rules rather than sort of vague principles to govern. I was wondering whether Alexander Hamilton's words are perhaps more prescient now in the current administration, where you see some of the administration's defense is saying that this is not a constitutional issue because it's not explicitly written in the Constitution, but perhaps that their actions are going against what was intended by the writers of, say, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution.
Great question. Really important one. As you say, both Hamilton and Madison originally opposed a Bill of Rights because they thought it was unnecessary. The Constitution was itself a Bill of Rights because Congress is only granted enumerated powers because it's granted no power to infringe free speech. No one would assume that it could infringe free speech. And the other objection, as you suggest, was that it would be dangerous to write down particular rights because people might assume if the right isn't written down, it's not protected. And both Madison and Hamilton believe that our rights, which come from God or nature and not from government, are so capacious that they can't be limited to a single list, and it would be dangerous to create a limited list. But in the face of protest from anti-federalists, including Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, I've learned to pronounce it pedantically gerrymandering, not gerrymandering, and Edmund Randolph of Virginia, and most importantly, George Mason of Virginia, the author of the Virginia Declaration of Rights, who refused to sign the Constitution because it had no Bill of Rights, Madison changed his mind and came to believe that the Bill of Rights could be useful, although he'd initially called it a parchment barrier, for greater security and safety to ensure that the federal government remained within its assigned limits. At the National Constitution Center, we have one of the 12 original copies of the Bill of Rights. George Washington sent 13 copies out to all the states and one to the federal government. 12 survive. What's so cool about this amazing document is, first of all, there are not 10 amendments, but 12. The original First Amendment doesn't involve free speech. It says that there has to be one representative in Congress for every 30,000 inhabitants. If that had passed, there'd be 4,000 people in Congress today. The original Second Amendment was not the right to bear arms, but the one that says that Congress can't raise its salary without an intervening election. That became the 27th Amendment in the 1990s. But there's a preamble to the original Bill of Rights, which I can't recite from memory, but is this beautiful statement that the members of the convention, in order to ensure greater security and safety and to prevent misconstruction, basically, have offered up these bills of rights, cut and pasted from the Revolutionary era state constitutions, just to make sure that Congress stays within its power. I've given a bunch of plugs for the interactive constitution, but among the other thrilling things that you can do on it is click on any right in the U.S. Bill of Rights and see its antecedents in the Revolutionary era state constitutions. So Madison, when he wrote the Bill of Rights, didn't make it up out of thin air, but cut and paste from the Virginia Declaration of 1776 or the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780. And by comparing the text of the state constitutions and Madison's language, you get a good sense of what Madison had in mind, and you understand why he changed his mind because he was about to lose a House election in Virginia, and basically there was so much anti-federalist spirit that he had to bow to the will of the people. But he came to be convinced in the great compromising spirit that reflected his temperament that better safe than sorry was the right approach.
We're speaking with constitutional scholar Jeffrey Rosen. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions. Please stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are at the College of the Atlantic as part of their inaugural Champlain Institute. My guest today, constitutional scholar Jeffrey Rosen. He leads the National Constitution Center, is also a law professor and author. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Jeffrey, before we go back to the questions, I want to ask you about what you're working on. I understand there's a book in the works.
There is, and it's going to be finished this week. I'm here on beautiful Mount Desert, my favorite place, finishing up the edits on a biography of that unappreciated constitutional hero, wait for it, William Howard Taft. This is a passionate case that President Taft was our most judicial president and presidential chief justice. He didn't want to be president. He'd been a former federal judge, and he yearned to be chief justice of the United States, and he achieved that ambition after he left the presidency, the only president to go on to serve on the Supreme Court. But he approached every decision as president in constitutional terms, and where Theodore Roosevelt thought the president could do anything the Constitution didn't explicitly forbid, Taft thought it could do only what the Constitution explicitly authorized. So Taft determined to put Roosevelt's progressive program on firm constitutional grounds. He didn't like the fact that Roosevelt used executive orders to protect the environment or prosecute the corporations and persuaded Congress to pass laws that enforced both of those provisions. Taft turned down a gift from the Japanese government because he thought it violated the Foreign Emoluments Clause to the Constitution, and he fought the election of 1912 to defend the restrained, thoughtful constitutionalism of James Madison against what he perceived to be the populist threats of both Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, who endorsed referenda, the initiative, and the recall of judges based on dislike of their decisions. As Chief Justice, Taft fulfilled his view of the courts as a fully independent branch of government, and according to the several historians, he was the most important chief since John Marshall in giving the Supreme Court control over its doctrine and making the federal judiciary a fully equal and independent branch of government. So this short, passionate case for the underappreciated William Howard Taft also argues he wasn't even large for most of his life. We think of him as our largest president. It was only because as president he ate his feelings. But after he left the presidency, he went on a paleo diet and lost 76 pounds in 6 months.
Oh.
And he was incredibly svelte and buff for most of his life. He was actually incredibly sexy as well as being a great constitutionalist. And this is a real case for that sexy constitutional president, William Howard Taft.
On that note, we're going to try the phones again. John in Cooper, top that. Are you there?
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. I'd like to ask Professor Rosen a couple of questions about the Constitution and climate change policy. Should the Paris Agreement been treated like a treaty and required Senate approval? And should interstate agreements like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative require congressional approval, as Article 1, Section 10 says?
Wow, those are such good questions, and I just do not know the answer to those questions. I would need to go to the interactive constitution and learn a lot more. I'm just going to do the standard law professor move when you don't know the answer, which is to give the homework back to you to answer it. Go to the interactive constitution, go to Article 1, look at the history of the treaty power, but those are serious and significant legal and constitutional questions. They deserve a great answer. I guess my final thing is, if you don't want to do it yourself, email me, jrosen@constitutioncenter.org, and I and the great constitutional prep team at the National Constitution Center will get on your question and we'll try to give you a good answer. We have this great feature called Ask Jeff, where people write in constitutional questions, and the prep team basically helps me answer them. And we will put our phenomenal NCC people on your question and get you a good answer. Thank
John,
you.
John, thanks for such a good question. And we do have a question from the audience. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Gray Cox. I'm here from College of the Atlantic. And boy, it's wonderful to catch your infectious enthusiasm for all these issues. Professor Rosen, I'd like to ask you a question about the amendment of the Constitution and the idea of having a constitutional convention. It would seem natural that a document that has been in effect so long, given the current pace of technology, would need some kinds of amendment. And there are certainly cases that people would point to, like Citizens United, for example, that seem to provide important challenges that might call for amendment to the Constitution to be addressed. And yet, on the other hand, many people would argue that having a constitutional convention opens up so many uncertainties that it's really prohibitive to try and do that, especially given the nature of our politics and technology today. I'm just wondering your thoughts about this. Effectively, can the Constitution be amended? Can we go through that process nowadays? And if so, how?
You've just beautifully and very effectively stated the arguments on both sides. And we have had several National Constitution Center debates on the question of, should we hold a convention of the states to amend the Constitution? That's because the Constitution can be amended in two ways. You can have Congress propose an amendment by two-thirds vote that is then ratified by three-quarters of the state legislatures or by conventions in three-quarters of the states. Or you can have two-thirds of the states call on Congress to summon a convention to propose amendments that are then ratified in the same way. Because Congress seems unlikely to propose an amendment to overturn Citizens United, for example, or even to require a balanced budget, 27 states have now called for a convention of the states to pass a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. We're only 7 states short of that convention actually being called, given the fact that the balanced budget is popular among Republicans and Republicans control three-quarters of the state legislatures. It's not inconceivable that you could get a majority to call a convention to pass a balanced budget amendment. Would that be a good idea? Well, the Constitution Center debates basically presented the arguments that you just beautifully summarized. The argument for it is the framers meant to have amendments, and that was the way the Constitution was supposed to be changed, and if people really want a balanced budget amendment, why not say so in the Constitution? The argument against is you could have a runaway convention, and at this NCC debate, David Super, S-U-P-E-R, of Georgetown Law School, basically said the people who are in the convention are going to be the same state legislators who everyone thinks are so corrupt and dysfunctional, and given the perilous state of our politics, do we really trust the convention to stick to a balanced budget amendment? Might it not repeal the First Amendment or change our whole system of government and so forth? Based on that argument, the audience voted before and after, and there was this dramatic shift in the votes, and although people had supported a convention before the debate, at least our audience was moved by the cautions of a runaway convention and voted against it at the end. But those are the arguments for and against. And it's not inconceivable that for the first time in American history, this convention of the states method of amending the Constitution might possibly be invoked.
All right. We'll go to Cumberland Forside and Bob. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. Three things. Two, Jennifer, you do a great job. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Programming. And for Professor Rosen, I'm a fan of his. A book that I particularly like is the Supreme Court.
Oh, shoot.
Dude, don't cut out just
Did
when you're praising
you,
the
Bob?
Book. That was so nice.
I think he was going to praise your book on Supreme Court personalities.
Yes, it had the riveting title, The Supreme Court, as Bob said. And I'm so glad you liked it.
Oh, Bob, I hope you're going to try to call back
and
very quickly because we don't have tons of time here. We're going to go to Tony in Portland. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi. It appears as though the Congress has very few tools available to it for the removal of the president. And should his behavior be non-impeachable, is there anything in the 25th Amendment that the Congress could use to explore his removal?
Yes. The Section 4 of the 25th Amendment provides for cases of presidential disability. So here's how it works. If the vice president and a majority of the cabinet decide that the president is disabled or unable to discharge his duties, they can vote temporarily to remove him. If the president by chance says, hey, I'm not disabled, I'm perfectly fine, I'm feeling just standy, then the Congress ultimately has to decide whether or not he's disabled, and it's a vote, once again, of the removing body, the vice president and the majority of the cabinet, ratified by two-thirds of both houses of Congress, who can remove the president against his objection. Birch Bayh, who proposed the 25th Amendment, said that the decision about presidential disability is ultimately a political, not a medical question. It was passed in the wake of President Eisenhower's stroke and then the JFK assassination, and Senator Bayh said, it's not up to doctors or mental health professionals. Ultimately, two-thirds of Congress should decide whether the president is disabled. So all this is to say that it's possible, but it's even harder than impeachment, because impeachment just requires a majority vote of the House and two-thirds conviction in the Senate. Here you need this complicated vice president plus a majority of the cabinet ratified by two-thirds of both houses of the Senate. Both impeachment and the 25th Amendment a political question, but harder to get the majorities under the 25th Amendment.
Tony, thank you for your call. Another audience question here.
Yeah, hi, I'm Mark Puglisi, and I teach history here on the island, as a matter of fact.
Wonderful.
And I want to ask you a hypothetical, because this is a hypothetical, actually, I ask my students. And I just have to preface it very quickly with a little philosophical background that you already know of. There are certain things that are supposed to maintain our liberty. I'm thinking of Federalist 10, right? And one of those things is the fact that we are a republic and not a democracy. Because the founders were very afraid of direct participation in the government, which would maybe anger people, my friends on the left. But too much democracy is bad. You filter opinions through a representative body, hopefully the Senate. So that's one thing. And the second thing is the thing that we forget about is that size matters. What I mean by that, as you know, is an extensive large republic was supposed to be a check on the things that kill republics, which is faction. Faction rends republics apart. And so if you enlarge the size of the country, you multiply the number of factions, and each one becomes correspondingly smaller in power. So I explain this to my students, we read Federalist 10, and then I say, okay, so what about the internet? Mm. Because what we've done is we've reduced the size of the republic to zero. Now, if Madison's ideas are fundamental in understanding this thing. In other words, it's not just the mechanisms, but the very fundamental David Humean ideas about faction. If that's the thing that's made the thing work, and we see an increase in democracy over time, and we see a shrinking of the republic to zero, is the Constitution still relevant?
That was the most beautiful expression of the fundamental question we're asking all week here at the Champlain Institute that I can imagine. What would Madison think of our current presidency, Congress, courts, and media? And was his faith that, as you perfectly put it, an extended republic could mitigate the effects of faction, has it been obviated by the internet? I'm going to ask that question to many of our guests. The National Constitution Center has a 3-year initiative to answer it as well. And all I can do is to say it seems like one of the most profound questions facing our country that exists. And I suppose we should have a vigorous discussion, and thank you for beginning it, about has the internet reduced the size of the country to zero, or are in a multitude of chat rooms and Twitter groups and blogs and Facebook friend groups reconstructions of the smaller scale laboratories of democracy that Madison thought might survive. We talked last night about what Madison would make of tweeting presidents, because Federalist 10 also, as you know, says that direct communication between representatives and their constituents is the worst thing to be avoided because you need filtration rather than direct representation. So I don't have the answer, but I know that the question you pose so beautifully is a profound and fundamental one involving the future of American democracy. And I hope by the end of this week and ultimately by the end of this great 3-year initiative, which we're calling a Madisonian Constitution for All, we will have a series of really fascinating and powerful answers. Thank you for that profound question.
We have an email from Jim. Will there ever be anything that checks a majority leader in the Senate from refusing to consider a Supreme Court nominee at any time, even for 2 years minus one day?
No, I don't think so. And I fear, or like, I'm not allowed to fear because I'm nonpartisan, I believe that it may be impossible for a president to confirm a Supreme Court justice unless his party or her party holds the Senate. Now, I think that's maybe where we're at. Imagine that, hypothetically, the Republicans were to lose the Senate in the midterm elections. I don't believe the Democrats would confirm any more Trump nominees that he were to nominate, even though he's in his second 2 terms. And similarly, if a Democrat won the White House the next time around and the Republicans kept the Senate, I don't think the Republicans would confirm any Democratic nominees then either. So this is just where we're at. I can say descriptively that this is an unusually polarized state of affairs. Louis Brandeis waited 127 days between nomination and confirmation. That record was surpassed by Merrick Garland by a long shot. And the framers viewed the confirmation as a political process, and the election of 1800 was so incredibly polarized that the outgoing Federalist reduced the size of the Supreme Court in order to deny the incoming Jeffersonian Republicans the opportunity to make appointment. So it's certainly not the case that we had a halcyon of bipartisanship in the past, but we are in a place where you need the Senate to get a Supreme Court justice through.
There's a lot of speculation right now about Justice Kennedy. Do you have any inside information? Do you have any idea if he's going to retire?
Yes, he's told me alone whether he's going to retire.
I love scoops on Maine College.
Just great. I'm not going to share it, you know, because I told him I... Well, that, it's such a funny question. People think I've been covering the court for 20 years, and every June it's who's going to retire and who do you know? And of course you don't know. Who do the justices tell they're going to retire? Nobody. They don't tell anyone until they actually retire. So I've read the speculation along with everyone else, and people reading tea leaves think that he may have been thinking about retiring before the election and may or may not have changed his mind, but when Justice Kennedy retires, all of us will learn at the same time.
Well, in the few seconds we have left, let me rephrase this question. Having studied what happened before other justices retire, are you seeing similar signs?
People usually say, gosh, I want to go out and play golf. I need a little more time with the kids. No, this is not. This is out of the many things that you can do in Supreme Court Kremlinology. It's so, I mean, these things are so personal. So Justice O'Connor, we know from history, wanted to retire, and she was about to do so. And then Chief Justice Rehnquist came to her and said, no, I want to retire first. And then he got thyroid cancer, and then they both ended up leaving at the same time, and then Justice O'Connor came to regret it. So all of them care about the institution, they care about their families, and the confluence of those factors are deeply personal, and they come together when they do.
Well, Jeffrey Rosen, what a treat to have you on Maine Calling. Thank you to Jeffrey Rosen, and thank you to our beautiful audience here. Jeffrey Rosen.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for a great conversation.
President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. We have enough time for you to give the name of the app again.
It's called the Interactive Constitution in the App Store for free or at constitutioncenter.org.
President and CEO of the National Constitution Center and a professor at George Washington University's Law School on leave, also with the Brookings Institute, and a contributor to The Atlantic, and his book on President Taft comes out next year. I'm feeling like an underachiever. We'd like to thank the College of Atlantic for hosting our show today. John Keimel ran the board today. Nick Godfrey and Dave Bartlett made this all technically happen for us. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation with Pulitzer Prize winning historian Frances Fitzgerald. We'll be discussing her new book, which tells the story of the evangelical movement in America. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.